Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Monthly Bible Study, where we are trugging along in our trek through the general epistles, and Mr. Myers will finish that off with all of you when we are elsewhere. But, well, I shouldn't speak on his behalf. Maybe he'll call it quits after 1 Peter. I don't know. But we have made it up to 1 Peter chapter 3 now, so let's begin by asking God's blessing, and then we'll pick it up where we left off. Our Father in heaven, great God, we come before you today on this beautiful Sabbath day that you provided for us. We thank you so much for your church, for the opportunity to come learn together, Father, with brethren of like mind who are all striving to live in a way that is pleasing to you. And we come before you now asking for your blessing on this Bible study. Bless the speaking as well as the hearing, and bless our ability, Father, to take these things and to put them into practice in our lives. We give you thanks, and we ask all this now in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. So last month, Mr. Myers covered the final few verses in chapter 2 of 1 Peter. So we're going to pick it up in 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, where we read, "Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives." Now there's a word that jumps out at me in verse 1, probably jumps out at some of you too. The word, likewise. Ooh, you might have thought I was going to say submissive, but actually the word likewise jumps out at me because wives are spoken to here and it says, wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands. Why did Peter phrase it that way? Well, when we stop and consider what Peter had been discussing in the previous chapter, we see that this concept of submission isn't a new topic. It's something he's been addressing throughout chapter 2. In the final verses in chapter 2, we read about the example of submission of Jesus Christ, that he submitted to the suffering and death in our place that was part of God's plan. And a little further back in chapter 2, we were told to be submissive to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. We submit to the governing authorities of this world. Servants are addressed in chapter 2, verse 18, and are told to be submissive to their masters. So this idea of submission isn't a new one in chapter 3. It's continuing in this same vein. Peter's going through different roles that Christians have the opportunity to shine as an example in through their attitude of humility and submission. We do that in our obedience to the governing authorities of this world, in our obedience to our masters, our employers, and striving to be a good example to them as well. We follow the example of submission of Jesus Christ. And we do that in our roles as husbands and wives as well. So when Peter writes to your wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, you know, the word likewise means similarly. So similarly, as we submit to governing authorities, as we submit to our masters, as Jesus Christ himself submitted to the will of the Father, similarly, wives, be submissive to your own husbands. And we stop and think about all of these opportunities to be submissive and the example of Jesus Christ himself. They're all for a greater purpose. It's submission for a greater purpose. Submission for the purpose of being an example to the world. And when we stop and consider the roles of husband and wife, we certainly have an opportunity to be an example to the world around us, to shine as lights by filling those roles in a different way than what is normal in the world around us. So Peter says here, wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands. This Greek word that's translated be submissive is the term hupotasso, and it means to arrange under or to subordinate, to subject or put in subjection, to subject oneself or to obey, to submit one's control. These are all different definitions from Thayer's. So you get the sense of this being something that is voluntarily done. And William Barclay's commentary on this verse has something to say about that I think is helpful. Barclay says, "It's not a spineless submission that is meant, but rather what has been described as voluntary selflessness. It is submission which is based on the death of pride and on the desire to serve. It is the submission not of fear, but of perfect love." I just love that phrase, voluntary selflessness. When you think of submission in that way, as a voluntary act of selflessness, then this word likewise makes a whole lot of sense in verse 1. After just reading about the example of Jesus Christ, of his voluntary submission to the will of the Father to be our sacrifice for our sins, then it makes perfect sense that Peter writes here, likewise. He's our perfect example of submission, of yielding to the plan of the Father. And he's the perfect example of submitting for a greater purpose. He submitted to this suffering that he endured for the furtherance of God's plan, for our salvation. So wives, likewise, voluntarily arrange themselves under the leadership and authority of their husbands. Likewise, for a greater purpose, because of what these roles in marriage symbolize. If you'll turn back to Ephesians chapter 5, we'll read about that here in Ephesians 5, beginning in verse 22. Very similar passage of scripture here, this one written by Paul, which I just think shows, again, the inspiration of the Word of God, that Peter and Paul wrote these two different sections that are so similar and complement each other so well. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22 says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her." If we drop down to verse 32, Paul writes, "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." So these roles of husband and wife are a type of Christ and the church, the relationship between Jesus Christ and the church. When a wife voluntarily submits to the leadership role of her husband, that's symbolic of the church voluntarily submitting to the leadership of the head of the church, Jesus Christ. We're representing something much bigger when we fill these roles in the way God has called us to do so. And when we do that, when we, as wives, I shouldn't say we, because I'm not one, but when you as wives voluntarily submit to the leadership of your husbands with this willing attitude, it can serve as a powerful example of the effect of Christianity in your life. Just like the example of obeying the laws of the land, just like the example of a servant serving his master with all of his energy. You know, it serves a greater purpose. It serves as an example of the effects of Christianity on the lives of God's people. When a wife voluntarily, willingly submits to the leadership of her husband, it will stand out in this world. And I've used this example before, but think about being at a wedding for members of the Church of God. You can always tell which guests are not members of a Church of God group, because when it gets to the portion of the service when the bride is promising in covenant with God, and the last portion of what she promises to do is, as God has ordained, to submit myself to him. And you see anyone who was possibly dozing off at that point, their head pops up, and they look around to see if other people heard the same thing. Did she just say she's going to submit to him? You know, it's not the norm in our world. It's not the norm in marriage in the world around us, which again is why it can shine as such a light to others, can be such an example of the effects of our beliefs on our conduct. Just a side note, though, we as husbands can help our wives fulfill this directive of submitting to their own husbands. We can help them to do that by being men who are easy to submit to, by being loving, reliable, gentle, considerate in our leadership. It's a whole lot easier to submit to someone whom your wife trusts, whom she trusts has her best interests at heart. Then she's happy to voluntarily submit to your lead. Back in 1 Peter chapter 3 here, Peter continues in verse 1, "Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands." Just want to stop and draw at the point there that when someone agrees to become the wife of a husband, She's agreeing to this role of submission to his leadership, which really underscores the importance for young ladies to be sure that the man that they are going to marry is someone that they're willing to submit to. It should be part of the consideration that goes into that decision of accepting a proposal. Now, is this someone that I'm going to willingly be able to submit myself to? It's just something for our young ladies to consider. Peter continues that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. So again, Peter speaks to the power of example here. And he says the silent, righteous example of a wife can even in some circumstances be enough to win a husband over. Her righteous example won't only stand out in the world, it can stand out in her own home as well. Thayer's Greek definitions, Greek lexicon, for the word here, the word that's translated won, that he may be won by the conduct of his wife. It means to gain or acquire. An example they give is to win him over to the kingdom of God, or to gain Christ's favor and fellowship. I think it's important to note here that it says that even if some do not obey the word, without a word, they may be won by the conduct of their wives. It doesn't say they will be. This shouldn't be taken as, exactly what's going to happen in every circumstance, so that if you are married to an unbeliever who isn't won over to this way of life, that somehow you've failed in your example. But Peter's point is your example can be so powerful that it could have that effect, that it could have that effect of him being won over by your conduct. And perhaps that could mean being won over in terms of being fully committed and converted to this way of life. Or perhaps it could just be won over in terms of him being accepting of what you do, of what you believe, of teaching these things to your children, of not giving you a hard time about it. There are different ways to look at this being won over by the conduct of your wife. But Peter continues here in verse 2 and says that this possibility of a husband being won over by the conduct of his wife, verse 2, it's when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. It's in observing the way you live that this being won over could happen. The word for observe means to inspect, to watch or behold, to view attentively. And when you stop and think about it, does any other human being see your true character more than your spouse? They see what you're really like behind closed doors. They see what's really going on in your heart, what you're struggling with, what your strengths are, and yet they love us anyway. It's pretty amazing. But the unbelieving spouse here has that opportunity to inspect, to observe, to see if what you say you believe is really having an effect on your life. And it can be a powerful example. They observe your chaste conduct. The word for chaste means sacred or pure, pure from carnality, modest, pure from every fault, immaculate, clean. It can also mean an exciting reverence. So when they observe your excited reverence for this way of life and your desire to be pure from the ways of this world, that conduct can have this powerful effect on their lives. Conduct simply means your manner of life, your behavior, your normal way of being. And your spouse, more than anyone else, gets to see what that normal way of life and being is. Peter continues in verse 2, they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Coupled with fear, coupled with the Greek word phobos, which we've talked about before, which can be a terror or it can be a reverence, especially when it's used in terms of speaking of God. A reverence of God. And I think when we stop and consider what Peter's writing here, I think that's what this chaste conduct accompanied by fear is. This chaste conduct is accompanied by a fear of God, not by a fear of your spouse. Unfortunately, the idea of submission is often taken in that light, that somehow if the husband is a strong enough authority and he can just make his wife submit, if he could just drive this fear into her, then she'll be submissive. Well, As we've talked about, submission is a voluntary act. You can force someone to comply, but you can't force someone to really voluntarily be selfless. You can't do that. So, unfortunately, some men have come up with that way of reasoning or thinking in terms of how their wives should submit. But submission of a godly woman is motivated by fear of God, not by fear of her husband or fear of consequences. It has that bigger picture in mind, submitting with a purpose to be an example for her spouse and for the world. And in that vein of considering your conduct so you can be that example for your husband, whether he's converted or not, you're still an example for your husband. Your chaste conduct still stands out. In that vein, Peter continues in verse 3, "Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God." Now, verse 3 in my Bible, New King James Version, the word merely is in italics, meaning it was added by the translator to help convey the true meaning of the passage. But if you take that word out, sometimes people read verse 3, "Do not let your adornment be outward, arranging hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel." And sometimes people read that and think, see, these worldly women who are doing their hair all fancy and putting makeup on and striving to be beautiful physically, they have the wrong perspective here. But is that what Peter's point is in this section? Is he condemning brushing your hair or trying to look nice or wearing jewelry or stylish clothing? I mean, is that his point, really? No, his point is this contrast between the focus on the exterior versus the focus on the heart. This outside beauty and adornment versus the inner beauty of the heart. And this external beauty, this external adornment is temporary. It's corruptible. It will pass away. When you stop and consider, is that what Peter is doing here? Is he condemning any type of adornment? Or is this word merely appropriate? Well, stop and consider what God is like. God is not against beauty. Look around you in the world. Look at the mountains, the ocean, the colors of a beautiful sunset, the variety of creatures that he made with their beautiful coats and feathers. Is any of that adornment really necessary? Not really. But it's an added beauty that God has given to us to enjoy in his creation. God made that beauty to be enjoyed. He loves beauty. He's not against it. But Peter's point is that God also loves priorities. So if our focus is merely on external beauty to the neglect of the beauty of one's character, then that becomes a problem. If you spend all of your time on a Sabbath morning to get yourself prepared to go to church and look impressive to the neglect of your prayer and Bible study that day, that's a wrong balance of priorities. You know, so Peter's talking about priorities here. He's talking about adorning what's lasting, adorning your character. He's not condemning any type of attempt to adorn your physical appearance. In verse 4, he said, "Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart." The hidden person, the concealed or secret person of the heart. What's private or hidden or inward, Thayer says. That's what should get our attention. It's as if Peter is saying, adorn that, the hidden person of the heart. Spend your time fixing that up, examining that closely in the mirror, striving to correct the smallest imperfections in your character rather than in your physical appearance. He says, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. This word incorruptible means undecaying. Thayer says it's not liable to corruption or decay. It's imperishable. It's lasting, this incorruptible beauty of the inner person of the heart. The physical is temporary and passing away. It's corruptible, but the beauty of one's character is not. It's the only thing that will truly last. And Peter says here at the end of verse 4 that that is what is truly beautiful to God. It's precious in his sight, this incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. The word for gentle means mildness of disposition or gentleness of spirit or meekness. You know, a humble attitude, a humble approach. And quiet spirit, this word for quiet, it's not describing a shy personality or a limited decibel range, but rather an overall disposition of just being peaceable, a peaceable approach. Strong says it means properly keeping one's seat. Thought that was interesting. Keeping one's seat, that is, by implication, being still, undisturbed, or undisturbing, being peaceable or quiet. And sometimes we can best understand the beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit when we consider the opposite. An aggressive, controlling, obnoxious, outspoken, contentious personality that always just has to speak their piece about something, that has to have the grip on the steering wheel and be in control of things. That's the opposite of this gentle and quiet spirit that Peter describes here. In the Proverbs, do not speak highly of that type of approach. They refer to that type of approach, that aggressive, outspoken approach, as a contentious woman. And the Proverbs say things like, a contentious woman is like a continual dripping, an annoyance. Or it's better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious woman. Or better to dwell in the corner of a housetop, corner of a rooftop, than in a home with a contentious woman. Does not speak highly of this type of approach. But Peter speaks very highly of the opposite here, the humble, peaceable approach of submission. And he says it's that type of approach, that type of attitude that's very precious in the sight of God. You stop and think about it. Why do people in general, I suppose, but especially ladies, why do they adorn themselves? Isn't it because they want to be considered beautiful, attractive, well thought of? Well, we're told here that if you want to be beautiful, lovely, attractive to God, this is the way to do it. With this gentle and quiet spirit, this peaceable, humble approach, this attitude of submission. Gentle and quiet does not mean weak. Gentle and quiet means settled and in control of one's emotions with a willingness to voluntarily submit. If we continue in verse 5, Peter writes, "For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands." Peter's saying this is how holy, righteous women who truly trust in God have always adorned themselves down through history. And it should be just as true today as it has been down through history. Having this gentle and quiet spirit is not a matter of culture. It's a matter of character. This meek, gentle demeanor might come more naturally for some people than for others, for some personalities than for others. But a difference in personality doesn't excuse anyone from striving to grow in the traits that Peter describes here. It might be harder for some, but the standard's still the same. Because of that bigger picture, because of the fact that we get to represent this relationship between Christ and the church, and we get to shine as lights of God's way of life to all those around us in the world. The fact that Peter refers to this type of attitude or approach here as also an adornment is interesting to me. You know, he contrasts the physical adornment of one's physical appearance with the beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. And in verse 5, he talks about these holy women who adorn themselves with this type of spirit, with this attitude of submission. I find that interesting because just like arranging the hair or putting on jewelry or clothing requires time and effort, purposeful action, I think the same is true about taking on this attitude of a gentle and quiet spirit. It doesn't just happen on its own. It might be more natural for some personalities than others, but it still takes effort. I mean, how many of you ladies woke up today and you rolled out of bed and said, oh, my hair's all done? I don't remember putting these pearls on, and I look pretty good. I think I'm ready for church. You know, it takes effort on your part for that physical adornment, and especially for that spiritual adornment, that adornment of the heart and the character. At the end of verse 5, Peter says, these holy women adorn themselves in this way, being submissive to their own husbands. So submission to their husbands was one way that this quiet and gentle spirit that God desires was shown among faithful women down through history and faithful women today. It's just one way that that attitude, that beautiful attitude to God, is evidenced. So submission is a voluntary act to accomplish a greater goal. It can't be forced, and it must be deliberately chosen. Then Peter goes on here in verse 6 to give an example of one of these faithful women of history. He says in verse 6, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. Now the word Lord here is a title of honor. Thayer says it's a title of honor expressive of respect and reverence. So Sarah used this title for Abraham, or this word to refer to Abraham, as an expression of respect and reverence for him and his leadership of their family. It denotes a sense of power or rule or authority that's involved. It's obviously not a term we use commonly today. I haven't heard any of the wives in this room refer to their husbands as Lord recently. But perhaps a term like leader might be more comfortable for us. Now, he's the leader of our family. We do hear people say things like that. But the word we use isn't what's important. The attitude is. And Sarah set this beautiful example of viewing her husband as the leader of their family and being happy to do that, happy to submit to his lead. Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 18 for an example of that in the life of Sarah. Genesis chapter 18, we'll begin in verse 6. This is jumping into the middle of the story when beginning of the chapter, it says, the Eternal appeared to Abraham by the terebinth trees of Mamre, and he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. We pick it up in verse 6. It says, so Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, quickly, make ready 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes. And Sarah replied and said, who do you think I am, Betty Crocker? No, it doesn't say that, sorry. Verse 7 says, and Abraham propped up his feet and took a nap until Sarah was finished. No, it says, Abraham ran to the herd, took a tender and good calf, gave it to a young man, and he hastened to prepare it. So he took butter and milk and the calf which he had prepared and set it before them. He stood by them under the tree as they ate. So they had this team approach in their marriage. Abraham asked her to do something, and he also pitched in. They got it done. But continuing in verse 9, it says, then they said to him, where is Sarah, your wife? So he said, here in the tent. And he said, I will certainly return to you according to the time of life. And behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. Sarah was listening in the tent door, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Therefore, verse 12, Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? So here's an example of a time when we see Sarah referring to Abraham in this term of endearment, this term of honor and respect, my Lord. But the reason why I wanted to turn to this example is because it's interesting when she used this term. Verse 12 says, therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I've grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also. She was in the tent by herself, and she laughed within herself and said these things to herself. So even when others weren't around, even when she was alone in the tent, presumably, she still had this attitude and approach toward her husband, this honor and respect toward him, even using this respectful term, my Lord. I think that's a beautiful example. You can see why Sarah is such a powerful example that Peter would refer to here. her example of obedience and willing submission to the lead of her husband. If we turn back to 1 Peter chapter 3, the end of verse 6, Peter again is speaking here to you ladies, you wives in the room. And he said, after giving this example of Sarah obeying Abraham, calling him Lord, he says, whose daughters you are if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. You can consider yourselves daughters of Sarah, following in her footsteps and her righteous example. If you do good in these things, presumably Peter's talking about the things that he was just talking about in the last six verses, this gentle and quiet spirit, this attitude of submission, this beautiful conduct that's an example for others. You can consider yourselves the daughters of Sarah if you continue in these things and are not afraid with any terror. It's an interesting phrase. It causes me to raise my eyebrows when I first read it. And are not afraid with any terror. What is Peter talking about there? Well, some commentators think that this ties back to the concept in verse 1 of a woman being married to an unbeliever. And the fact that coming to the knowledge of the truth, converting to Christianity, without her husband experiencing that same conversion, could be a fearful thing, especially in the first century, when female independence of thought was pretty uncommon. Now, women were considered more like objects than individuals. So for a woman to be called into God's church, into the truth, without her husband experiencing that, could be a fearful thing for her to have the courage to step up and continue to live this way of life, even if her husband wasn't won over by her conduct. It can be a fearful thing and can take a lot of courage. But Peter here is encouraging women in the church to not have that fear, to not be afraid with any terror, to follow in this example. Even if your husband isn't won over by your conduct, you can still trust that having this gentle and quiet spirit, this attitude of submission, following the roles in marriage that God has set up, will still lead to you living a blessed life. It might not always be easy, but Peter's encouraging the women here to stick with it. Continue to do good in these areas. Don't be afraid with any terror. Another possible application of this concept of not being afraid with any terror that comes to my mind is related to personalities. Because sometimes giving up control can be a fearful thing. For some women who just have a more natural desire to be in the driver's seat, it can be a fearful thing to let go of that authority, that grip on the steering wheel, of being the one that's in charge, being the one that's taking the lead. We can also take this admonition from Peter to not be afraid with any terror from that perspective. Don't be afraid to submit to the roles in marriage that God has ordained. We can trust that God's way works and not be afraid to take on those roles, especially when we take time to consider the person that we're going to marry, consider whether or not he's going to be someone we're willing to submit to voluntarily. In verse 7, Peter continues, now shifting gears, speaking to the husbands. Verse 7, husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. And one commentary I was reading was talking about why six verses for wives and only one verse for husbands? Some of you ladies might be wondering the same thing. I don't have the perfect answer. That commentary I was reading was talking about what a challenge it would have been for women at this time in the first century to take this step of faith and living God's way of life, even if their husband was not. And this commentator's opinion was that that's why there were six verses devoted to the wives and only one to the husbands, because it would have been harder for women to do it on their own than for men to necessarily do it on their own without their wives. But nonetheless, verse 7, husbands, that word likewise appears again. I think it could refer to likewise in terms of just like the women have to put effort into adorning the inner person of the heart. They have to put effort into willingly taking on this attitude and approach of submission. Husbands, likewise, have to put effort into these things that Peter is going to tell us we need to focus on. But that likewise could, once again, also come back to the different examples in chapter 2 of submission that we read. Likewise, just like we submit to governing authorities, just like servants submit to masters, just like we strive to follow the example of Jesus Christ, likewise, husbands have to do that as well. So husbands, in a sense, we have to submit to these directives that Peter gives us here. It says, husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding. Now, dwelling with understanding, I think, can take on, two different types of dwelling with understanding. Dwelling with a general understanding and dwelling with an individual understanding. What I mean is dwelling with the general understanding of the differences between men and women. Differences between the way we think or feel or process things. Differences in our needs. Peter tells us to dwell with understanding, realizing that we are different from each other as men and women. But we also have to dwell with an understanding of our wives individually. What she personally needs. How she feels loved or appreciated or cared for or protected. What makes her feel secure. So again, just like a wife striving to adorn her character in a beautiful way, we have to strive to understand our wives. We can't dwell with them with understanding unless we're putting the effort in to try to understand them better. And that requires effort on our parts as husbands to be attentive, to learn the needs of our wives, to learn her love language, what makes her feel appreciated or cared for. Peter continues, we dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel. So we're instructed to be considerate of our wives here. Not only to understand them, but to go a step further and then be considerate because of that understanding we have of our wives. Dwelling with our wives with understanding has to then translate into action on our part. Considerate actions. We need to understand that we're different and then consider how to take those differences into account in our approach with our wives. We have to consider how to honor her, how to build her up, how to convey that we are thinking about her and that she is loved. When Peter says here, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, he's speaking in terms of physical comparison, in stature physically compared to her husband, usually. The wife is the weaker vessel. Weaker doesn't mean she has less spiritual potential or less value. She simply fills a different role, serves a different purpose. She's the fine china. We're like the old skillet. Both are needed, both are necessary, but they serve different purposes. One's more fragile than the other. This isn't, speaking against the women, like calling them weak. It's just simple fact that they're created differently from us. But Peter continues here, as to the weaker vessel and as being heirs together of the grace of life. So he encourages us here as husbands to be ever aware of the fact that she has the same spiritual potential that we do. Family roles and responsibilities, those are designated and limited by God. But the spiritual development of our wives is not. They have the same spiritual potential, the same eternal potential that we as men do. So although men are called to take a leadership role in the family, we're to always remember that that's a temporary position of authority. Our wives have the same eternal potential that we do as members of the family of God. And we're to treat our wives as those precious daughters of God that they are called to become. In the last phrase in verse 7, we do all these things. As husbands, we consider these things. We dwell with understanding. We give our wives honor as to the weaker vessel. We remember that they're heirs together with us of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. If we set marriage aside just for a minute and consider in general what kinds of things can potentially hinder our prayers. The first one that jumps to my mind is sin. We know that sin separates us from God. Proverbs 28, verse 9, says, "One who turns away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer is an abomination." So sin can hinder our prayers. How about pride? In Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14, we read the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. And you're all familiar with that story. We know that it highlights two completely different approaches. This Pharisee that spoke to God and said, "I'm not like this tax collector over here. I fast twice a week. I do this, I do that." As if God should be forced to listen to him and answer his prayers because of his own righteousness. And the approach of the tax collector was, "I'm nothing. I don't deserve anything that you have to offer. But I'm coming before you and asking for it anyway." And who in that story was heard by God and whose prayers were hindered? So we see pride can be a hindrance to our prayers. So sin, pride, how about a lack of forgiveness? In Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 through 24, Jesus Christ talks about, if you're going to the altar to give a gift, and on your way, you remember that your brother has something against you, go and first be reconciled to your brother, and then come give your gift to God. Also in Matthew chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, we're told that if we don't forgive others, we won't be forgiven ourselves of our own sins. So a lack of forgiveness or a bitterness towards someone else can cause a hindrance in our prayers to God. So sin, pride, a lack of forgiveness or bitterness, these are just a few examples of things that can hinder our prayers. So now coming back to the context here, in terms of husbands and our role. And Peter says we should fill these roles, these directives that he gives us, that our prayers may not be hindered. So if sin, pride, lack of forgiveness, or bitterness towards others can hinder our prayers, how much more so if those things are directed toward our wives? If we're sinning against our wife? If we're taking a prideful approach toward her, ruling over her, rather than serving with an attitude of humility? Or if we are withholding forgiveness, holding on to bitterness toward her, how much more will our prayers be hindered when we do that to the one that God's called us to be one flesh with, the one that we're instructed to love like our own body? It's impossible to have our prayers be unhindered if we go to God with an attitude of pride or superiority or bitterness toward others, especially our wives. Our relationship with God and our relationship with others can't be compartmentalized. If we're not loving our neighbor as ourselves, then our prayers will be hindered. And our wives, they are our closest neighbor. So we might ask ourselves after reading this section in 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 7, you know, we didn't know how it would work out when we would be covering each section in these books. I'm sure we thought we would be done long ago. But now, before Passover of all times, to cover a section on marriage, I think it would be a good time to read this and consider it. A good time for us as husbands and wives to read these instructions from Peter and to ask ourselves if these are potential growth opportunities for us. Are these areas that may be handicapping our spiritual development, our relationship with God, if they're left unaddressed? So I'll hand it over to Mr. Myers now, and he can continue with 1 Peter 3, verse 8.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Heard Mr. Smith give this a few weeks ago in Youngstown. It's just gotten better since that time. Appreciate that very much. In verse 8, actually took longer than last time, too.
That's why it was better.
That's right. Verse 8 starts with the word finally. So after all this, he comes to this summary word, finally. So if we were to take everything that we've covered up to this point in the last probably half of chapter 2 and into chapter 3 here, now we get a summary statement. So he's talking about this concept of submission, the result of that instruction about submitting to government authorities, submitting if you're a servant to the master, submitting if you're a wife to your husband, in marriage, Christ, the example of submitting. So then he summarizes by saying, finally, now what's to be the end result in behavior out of all this? Finally, all of you be of one mind. Unity is not possible without submission. And the result of this attitude and this approach of being submissive brings about unity. Now, again, if we start backing up from where we were, we take that concept within marriage. If there's no mutual submission in marriage, is there unity or is there head-to-head? Is there constant upset? Usually, how about servants and masters? If there's no submission, are you going to have unity? No, there's going to be always an axe to grind. There's always a problem going on. So Peter instructs us about the unity and the compassion that should flow from mutual submission. So finally, all of you be of one mind, in other words, unified, having compassion for one another. So this mutual submission, this attitude of I am under God's authority, I'm under Christ's authority, I'm submitting to each other, we're all in this boat together, striving to live God's way of life, striving to grow, unity of mind is the first thing that he mentions. And again, without unity of mind in the church, there can't be, without submission, I should say, there can't be unity of mind either. The New American Standard translates it this way. Finally, all of you be harmonious. Isn't that a good word for unity? Harmony. Now, what's interesting about harmony, I think this is one of the reasons the New American Standard uses this translation, is when we talk about harmony, what do we have? It's not unison, it's harmony. There's a difference. When a choir sings in unity, they're all singing the same notes at the same time. When we have harmony, there are people, different sections in this case, singing different notes. In fact, they may be at different times. The timing may be different, but they're always in harmony. It's pleasing to the ear. The opposite of that is called dissonance, when it grates the ear. And we could go into the musicality behind that, why the vibrations of certain notes fit together and the vibrations of other notes don't fit together, and it grates against our very being. but he says this mutual submission brings about harmony. And that's a beautiful characteristic to have in the church, beautiful to have in a family, beautiful to have in a work environment when there's harmony. I just got back from a few days at headquarters to do some recording and some teaching there. And it's wonderful to see the harmony. Very different personalities of Mr. Franks to Mr. Horchak to Mr. Taylor or to Mr. Kylo. And you can look at the various offices that are occupied beyond that, Mr. Meeker and Kelly Hogg. And, I mean, you just go down the list. And everybody's singing different notes, but all in harmony. It's just a wonderful thing to see. So harmonious. Wives and husbands are harmonious when there's mutual submission. When husbands care for their wives, there is harmony. When wives submit to their husbands, there's harmony. Again, different notes, sometimes different rhythms, but always in harmony. Can we think of treating all human beings in this manner? Now, Peter's talking primarily within the church, obviously. But is there a way that we can strive as Christians to help bring about harmony in other people's lives? Maybe if it's just for a very short time when we have some interaction with them, can we give them a pleasing sound? Being in the airports this week, it just amazes me how travelers often treat employees as if they are non-humans. I don't want to get graphic necessarily, but I went to the restroom in the airport. There's a fellow there cleaning the counter. And people are walking around this guy as if he doesn't exist. And it's just so sad to see that, well, it's his job, or, well, I don't know, throwing water on the counter. And it's just to stop and say, hey, you know, thanks a lot for the work that you do here. Really appreciate it. It's a nice, clean restroom. Thank you. And it's like, okay, there's that just for a second, maybe that tune that is beautiful and harmonious, and, oh, that's the way life is supposed to be. Appreciating people for what they do. I mean, the guy was so kind. He put his hand under the towel paper thing, and zzz, the towel paper comes out. He rips it off and hands it to me. Zzz, another one. Like, that's not his job. But give them just a little bit of harmony, and, ah, oh, that's the way life's supposed to be. That was kind, you know, kind of him to do that. So can we do this to others as well? Give them a small bit of that compassion, that harmony, that unity of mind. Show them an example of what life can be like that way. Conduct in the church. Am I compassionate? Be of one mind and be compassionate. Am I compassionate toward others in the church? New American Standard for that word compassion has the word sympathetic. And compassion and sympathy are different, but they go, it's not greatly different, but they go hand in hand. When we're truly sympathetic for another, we have more opportunity or better able to be compassionate toward them. So are we of harmony and are we of sympathy? When he says, you know, the end result of all this finally should be a harmony and a sympathy within families, within the church, within our work environment, as much as we can add to that, as much as we are able to do. Then he says, love as brothers. Love as brothers. New American Standard says, brotherly. Harmonious, sympathetic, and brotherly. It's interesting that the New Testament kind of continues on the theme of ancient Israel being, we're all brothers here. And now, again, God often in the Old Testament tells Israelites to be kind to their brothers. In other words, the rest of Israel. Now, they came to see it so drastically different that, okay, this is us, the brothers, Israel, and then it's all those others, the hateful, spiteful, Gentile, pig-eating people out there. Now, we don't like those people. Now, that's not what Christ said, but he continues on the theme that the closest relationship that he could think of to describe the way the church should be is that we are brothers. So you and I use the term pretty, well, just by habit. Oh, the brethren. It's interesting how we get used to these terms. We call it in-speak. It's what we speak about all the time. But most people never use that word. You probably realize that. My son-in-law, I think, asked a number of months ago, why do you call the church members brethren? Because they never use that term. Of course, he's Dutch as well, so you really wouldn't use it. But brethren? I mean, that's such an old term. That's like from the 1700s or something. The brethren, the church of the brethren. Why do we use that? Well, because God intends that this brotherly feel, that I would do anything for my brother. I've used the example before, how one time in high school, I was a freshman. I know, I was a sophomore. In our high school, it was sophomores, juniors, and seniors. And I was a sophomore in high school. And then my brother, my older brother Steve, was the next older brother, was a senior. So we crossed over one year in high school. Crossed one year in middle school, 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. When I was in 7th, he was in 9th. Then when I got to high school in 10th grade, he was in the a senior at that point. And for some reason, I had a shine for a particular young lady when I was a sophomore, and I think she kind of had a shine for me. Of course, guys always think that. Whether she did or didn't, I don't know, but there was another senior who also had a shine for this girl, and as a result, I was the enemy. So I'm walking down the hall one day, and I've got my books under my arm. All of a sudden, they go flying all over the hallway. And here's this guy. He wants to fight me about this girl. Like, seriously? I don't think I like her that much, but I don't know. Maybe I did. I don't know. But before I could turn around, hardly, there's my brother. And he's standing in between me and this other guy, and he's, my mother used to call him a bandy rooster. You know, he's gonna protect his little brother. Man, that's really a kind thing. The closest thing that we could think of, or that God apparently can think of, to describe the bond that ought to be between God's people is brothers. Now, if you've had a particularly turbulent childhood with your siblings. That's not probably what we should go back. Yeah, I was fighting with my brothers all the time. That's the way it should be in the church. Well, no, that's not the concept. So if we had a hateful relationship with our physical brother or sister, that's not the standard that God wants us to think about. So if you just take a moment here to turn to Proverbs 17, verse 17. Proverbs 17 and verse 17. Yeah, sometimes brothers do have squabbles, and they have some issues, but that's not the standard we're looking for. We're looking for a brother who will always be there for us, who will stand in for us when we need it, who help us out, drag us out of the pit if we need it, do what is necessary for our benefit, for our good. So Psalm 17, verse 17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. A brother is there to help, especially when there's tough times, when there's difficulties along the way. New King James says it that way. The New Living Translation renders it as a freer translation. It's not a literal translation, but a feel kind of translation. But it says it this way. A friend is always loyal, but a brother is born to help in time of need. In other words, I know families that, my stupid brother, I got to go help him again. Like he's done something stupid again, but I'm going to help him. I'm always there for him. I will be there. So ideally, that brother is supposed to be the closest of relationships, sticking together at all times, looking out for each other, helping each other, encouraging each other, all of those things, standing in the gap for each other, being there through thick and thin, helping during those times of adversity. So interestingly, God chooses this relationship to define how things should be among his people. You've heard the old saying that blood is thicker than water. Well, spirit should be the thickest of all. God's spirit unifying us as family members. So he says we ought to be harmonious. We ought to be sympathetic. We ought to be brotherly. And then he goes on to say even more than that, or continuing on, to be tender-hearted. Tender-hearted. Others render that kind-hearted. So again, we can ask ourselves as we analyze this, am I tender-hearted toward my brothers and sisters in the faith? Am I kind-hearted toward them? Has anyone ever said to you, that's such a kind thing for you to do? Thank you. Even if you don't say thank you, hopefully at some point someone will say, well, that was so kind. Kind of you to write, kind of you to call, kind of you to stop by, kind of you to ask. Whatever the situation might be, it's just so kind, tender-hearted. So is my heart tender toward the brothers and sisters in the faith? Hopefully it is. And then he says one more. He uses the word courteous. So again, the result of all this mutual submission, he says, is this unity, this sympathy, this brotherliness, this tender-heartedness, and then courteous. Other translations that render it humble in spirit. Humble in spirit. When you think about it, courtesy is an outgrowth of humility, being courteous to someone else. It's an outgrowth of humility. Rarely is a person who is arrogant courteous because he's better than everyone else. He's over other people. He doesn't have to stoop to their level. He's more important than they are. So we can ask, are we courteous toward others? Are we training our children to be courteous? Are we training them not to run in between people who are having conversations? Are we training them to be quiet when it's time to be quiet? Are we teaching them to talk when it's time to talk? When you say hello to Mrs. Smith, and are we teaching them to be courteous and respectful in those ways? Or do we make excuses that, well, they're having a hard day again today. Well, they've had a hard life for the last 8 years. How about time to help them be courteous? I'm exaggerating for effect, obviously. But again, courteous to each other. Sometimes as brethren, we can take each other for granted. So think about being courteous. So Peter summarizes all of that in this one verse, that you're harmonious, that we're sympathetic, that we're brotherly, that we're tender-hearted, and that we're courteous. Now, is that a great summary of Christianity in general? I mean, the effect of what our relationship with Christ should produce, that kind of person? Well, that's what Peter's kind of summarizing that way. So then we'll just cover one more verse and call it quit for today. he continues on with the result that if we're this way, here's another fruit of this submissive attitude toward God and toward each other. Not returning evil for evil. Boy, that takes, again, a submissive spirit as opposed to a fighting spirit, as opposed to a contentious spirit. And again, Peter's talking in the church. So what can be shocking to us is that when we receive evil from someone in the faith, it can be much more difficult on us spiritually, on us emotionally, than receiving evil from the swine-eating pagans out there. You know, we know what they're going to probably get from them. Well, not necessarily, but sometimes we do. It's harder when we get that kind of treatment from another Christian. But don't return evil for evil or reviling for reviling. So we're called to show an example. Reviling means to be, you know, put down, to be spoken evil of, to be talked rudely to. Sometimes that happens within the church. Someone gets weak. They get upset, they get emotional, they do things they shouldn't, and it can cause us real heartache. But don't return evil for evil. But on the contrary, blessing. So when someone gives us evil and we return a blessing, when someone gives us or talks badly about us, and instead of us spreading it around to all of our friends about how badly they said something or how badly they treated us, that we talk about them in a positive way, in a kind way, boy, that shows a different spirit residing in us than that resides in the world. So then he says, knowing this, or that, knowing that you were called to this. Well, wait a second. Part of the reason of our calling is to be abused? And the answer is yes. Why? Why would God allow that in his church? He allows it in the church so that we can show an example of how one should be when these things happen to us. Because if we return evil for evil to members of the faith, or we return reviling for reviling, we're just like the world. If you're talking about somebody secretly with others and going about, oh, this is what they're doing, oh, this is what they did, this is what they did, that's reviling, and it should not be done. Should not be done. So what's my response when someone brings this reviling to me as a church member? Now, counseling is a different story. But when someone brings reviling or these revilings to us, what do we say? Well, you know, you need to talk to that person. Sorry you've had that experience, but you shouldn't be talking with others about that. You need to go to the source. You need to get some counseling about that. To get this straightened out. It's not acceptable. And again, we're not trying to correct the person in front of them. We're just trying to help them. This is not a good approach to have. So we are called, and sometimes in that calling, we're going to be reviled. Evil is going to be done to us. And it's our responsibility to show Christ's Spirit in the middle of all that, God's Holy Spirit within us, to show how you deal with that. You return a blessing for that. You say something kind. You know what so-and-so said about you? This is what they said. Well, I just hope they'll get over that sometime. But I'm sure they must have had a hard day or something difficult was going on in their lives. And we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Wow. Someone say that? Can you imagine our executive officer tweeting something so kind? You know, oh, I'm sorry. He feels that way. I hope he's not having too bad a day. It's not God's Spirit. And again, whether you think he's a great president or a bad president, I don't care. He's not our president. He said, what do you mean? Well, he's the president of the United States, but who's our president? Well, we already know. Christ is our leader. He's our president in that sense. So don't get involved in the politics and all the hassle with that. If it happens among the brethren, return goodness and kindness for evil. It's the only way it's ever going to get better. So in that sense, don't return evil for evil. But on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, you were called in part to set an example of how to be mistreated, how to react when you're mistreated. It's part of our responsibility. to show how Christ did, to reflect his. Well, how did he end? Well, he was mistreated. Well, very differently than most of the world. So then he ends that verse by saying that you may inherit a blessing. God is the one that will bless us for that. We don't always have to make sure everyone else in the church knows that we were right about a situation and they were wrong about it. So we tell the story how many times to show that we're the right one and they're the wrong one? It's not necessary. What's that all about? It's about me, if that's the case. Well, I'm going to show everybody how bad they were. What's that all about? It's all about me. It's about how I think I look in front of others. And I look much better when I tell the story my way, even if I do embellish it just a little bit. But still, again, we inherit a blessing when we return good for evil, when we return kindness for being reviled. So with that, we'll go ahead and take a break till next month and pick it up with verse 10 next time we get together. Thanks for your time and attention.